anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. Ministers say the EU is determined to pursue these issues and to act to end the situation, but their demand does not spell out what measures might be taken if Tehran defies it. That discussion continues. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
More headaches today for airline passengers in Europe. This is day three of a strike by British Airways cabin crew. The airline has canceled more than half of its nearly 2,000 flights since that strike began over pay and working conditions. If the labor dispute drags on, a four-day strike will be launched on Saturday. At Lufthansa, the union representing pilots is calling for a four-day strike in mid-April. That's over pay and job security. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Siemens. From healthcare solutions to transportation systems, committed to answering America's toughest questions at Siemens.com/answers.
Hello, I'm Renee Montaigne of NPR News. And beginning Thursday, April 1st, you'll be able to hear NPR's signature morning news and information program. That's Morning Edition, weekdays from 6 till 9 a.m. on WILL-FM. Please tune in weekdays beginning Thursday, April 1st on WILL-FM and HD Urbana.
AM 580 will continue to bring you Morning Edition weekday mornings from 5 to 9 a.m.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, offering more than 3,000 certified organic products, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar and bulk foods department, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus 580 archives, so as you listen, do keep in mind, we'll not be taking your calls.
Now is behind bars here in The Hague. Karadzic
about the history of childbirth. And the guest for the program is a medical journalist and physician, Randi Epstein. She says that the way that we give birth is a story about our deepest concerns about life, death, and sex. We're creating life, and we will do anything we think is in our power to control the outcome. Certainly over time, people have done all sorts of things with that goal in mind. And where once we had superstition, now we have science. At the same time, she says, for all of our modern technology, we are still in the dark about so many things that go into making babies. So in this hour, we'll be talking about some of what you will find in her newly published book. The title is Get Me Out, A History of Childbirth from the Garden of Eden to the Sperm Bank. It's published by W.W. Norton. It's out now in the bookstores if you'd like to take a look at it. It's very interesting reading. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. Randi Epstein is a medical writer, a physician, and adjunct professor at the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. She's been a medical writer for the London Bureau of the Associated Press and also the London Bureau Chief of Physicians Weekly. She's contributed articles to different publications, New York Times, Washington Post, The Daily Telegraph, Parents, More, Harper's Bazaar, and others. She makes her home in New York. She's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions from listeners are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign, Urbana, the number to call is 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that. That's 800-222-9455. And you may also email your comments and questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. In any case, any of those avenues are welcome and open for your participation. We just ask people to try to be brief so we can keep moving along, but anybody who's listening is welcome to call. Dr. Epstein, hello.
Hi, thanks for inviting me.
Well, thanks very much for being with us. We appreciate it. I think one of the basic ideas that you try to get across, something I know you've said maybe surprised you a little bit when you started doing the research for the book, is that contrary to what we might think about childbirth in the past, so talking about the experiences of our grandmothers and great-grandmothers and on, that it was something really basic and straightforward, and it's just something that they just did and didn't worry about. You say that actually when you look at the history, in fact, it's something we've always been worried about.
It's true. I mean, you know, as a doctor and medical journalist and mother of four, I was always interested in childbirth. And when I started to investigate, I did find that I was surprised to see what a fascinating history we had. And yes, I did think that, well, you know, years back, women might have been rightly so frightened to death to become pregnant because they knew that, you know, it was not as safe as it is today, and they were worried. But I thought that at least they went into it without being bombarded with all this advice and without people saying do this and don't do that and worrying. But no matter how much things have changed from way back when, and things have changed tremendously, two things seem to have held constant. And one is that I always say, except for Eve, who didn't have mothers or sisters or guidebooks, ever since Eve, we have been flooded with guidebooks and advice from friends and advice from so-called experts. And the other thing that I think has always held constant is that we, as women and as parents, men too, we've always tried to do whatever we could to try to control this uncontrollable situation, whether it was, you know, drinking the right amount of red wine, you know, hundreds of years ago, or today picking the right sperm.
Yeah, and the book does indeed deal with not only the process of birthing, but it also does look at the whole matter of conception. And there again, you'd think, well, it was a long time ago that people figured out that when a man and a woman had intercourse, that she would get pregnant and there would be a baby. Although at the same time, I'm sure there were plenty of times when that people had intercourse and there was no baby, so people would have had to think, okay, what exactly is going on here? And that people have said all sorts of things over time about what it is exactly people should do and how they should do it if they really want to make a baby.
It's true. I mean, you know, fascinatingly, there were times, and it wasn't so long ago in history, not ancient history, but hundreds of years ago, where doctors got it mixed up and they thought women's pregnant time was actually during her menstrual cycle, which we know now is when you're not pregnant. And there were times in ancient history where they said, you know, you needed good sex to make good babies, or you had to think good thoughts. And you can imagine how women were always blaming themselves because if things didn't work out, they thought, gosh, was I thinking the wrong thing? Was I not enjoying it enough? What did I do? What did I do to make this not happen? Which I do think kind of goes through to today, because I think nowadays people will say, "What, you know, what am I doing wrong? Is there something in my lifestyle that's making this not happen?"
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's, I guess, one of the interesting things now that we do have a area of science that's dedicated to infertility and to trying to help people who are having a difficult time conceive, we've really come to an appreciation that, in fact, conception is actually pretty complicated. And, you know, for all of the talk that people have sex once and bang, that's it, it's really not like that. There are actually a lot of things that have to work the way that they're supposed to.
Oh, gosh, when you start looking into this, you start thinking it's amazing that there's any children that are actually born. Mm-hmm. You know, we still are in the dark about so many things, which I do think made the research of the book, even when we look at what's going on today, that interesting, because there's still so many unknowns. But we do know a lot more, and the more we know, the more we realize, yeah, it is a hugely complicated process. You know, and we've always tried to figure out, what can we do to uncomplicate it? What can we do to hedge our bets? And as I say, women will go and couples will go to desperate extremes. You know, we can laugh at what people did in the past. There was a queen years ago that I talk about in the 16th century who was told to use some sort of cow dung, they said, on her source of life, and we're trying to figure out what she did with that cow dung diaper. To increase fertility. And I'm convinced that 100 years from now, people are going to look back and see the things in our advice books and laugh at us.
Well, at what point did science proceed, at least to the point that there was this understanding that there was sperm, there were eggs, that the men produced the one and the women produced the other, and that what was happening, at least the basic level, they understood what was happening was the two things came together, and you couldn't do it without those two things coming together.
Well, sure. I mean, we've known that for years, but I do want to say in ancient times, it's interesting. We knew that men had what was called this seed, and actually it was called like their source of life. And in ancient times, it was thought that, I mean, real ancient times, it was thought that men had the seed of life. Men could make a baby. They had it all. And the women were just these hollow things that took the seed of life as if you were sort of a plant pot, and the seed was planted in you, and we grew the seed. But we did know that, I mean, it was someone way back in the second century, a little after that said, you know, maybe women have something to do with it too. But we weren't exactly sure. But there were some doctors then saying, you know, maybe it's not all men. Maybe the woman kind of plays a role in this also.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Randi Epstein. She's a medical journalist and physician. She's written for a number of publications, and she's the author of a newly published book just out from W.W. Norton. It's a history of childbirth from the Garden of Eden to the sperm bank. That's the subtitle. The main title of the book is Get Me Out, and it's just out now, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. If you go back long enough, you find that birthing was not only was the primary business of women, but it was women who helped other women give birth. If we go again back in the history of medicine, I think what you will find is that male physicians didn't want to have anything to do with it.
No, I mean, traditionally, this was an all-girls affair. And, gosh, you know, you didn't want men in the birthing room when you were there naked, legs apart, you know, having a baby come out. You had your grandmother, you had your mother, you hopefully had someone in town that had experience helping along the way. And when doctors started to learn about human physiology and started to learn about hormones and things going on in the body in the late 1800s, when they first started to say, gosh, maybe we could play a role in helping women give birth safely, a lot of doctors or young doctors in medical school really looked down on the profession, on this supposed new specialty, because they thought, why do they want to specialize in something that their grandmother had been doing? You know, it wasn't really this respected profession at the time. It was just sort of thought of something doctors should learn, but they really kind of didn't want to have to deal with.
And at what point then did male physicians actually start doing this?
Well, you know, there had been male midwives all along. I mean, you can go back into the 1500s, 1600s, and there were family of male midwives that were around. But it wasn't really the popular way to go, and they weren't medical doctors. Around the turn of the night, in the early 1900s, OBGYNs, obstetrics became a specialty, and they tried to increase their own respect, and they did by studying the female body, by looking at hormones, by trying to figure out how we can make this a safer process. And that's when you see the tension starting to rise between doctors and midwives, and that's when you see the confusion among women, because they were torn. Do I go to someone who went to medical school and claims he knows more, or do I choose the person with more experience? And a lot of times the midwives were the ones that had a lot more experience.
Yeah. And when we start to see the growth in the number of male physicians who are doing births, then we also see the growth of, let's say, technology, I guess, in the sense that we talk about it now, particularly appliances, tools.
Sure.
that were used to assist in the process. And there, I guess what you see also is that you would think that if there were physicians who had something that they thought was really good, would
right.
work really well, was good for women, they'd want everybody to have that, all the doctors to have that and use it. But no, the story really is actually different. And I guess I'm thinking about a family of physicians called the Chamberlains.
Yes, who supposedly discovered or supposedly created the first kind of forceps that got the baby out safely. And without going into the gory details, we can say that there had always been forceps around, but they weren't there to get the baby out safely. They were just there to get the baby out, sort of in pieces. and the Chamberlains claimed that they had forceps that got the baby out safely and kept the mother safe, too. Now, the odd thing about them is they were this famous family of male midwives, and because they felt that they had this great thing that would save so many lives of babies and mothers, let's not share the information. Let's keep it to ourselves, because then that'll help increase our market and make us the midwives to the royalty. They were based in England, and it worked. They became these famous elite male midwives. You know, and we can look back and say, well, that was horrible. Why didn't they just sell their equipment? You know, they could make money off of it and give it to other doctors. But that was really the way medicine was done then in the 1600s. It was highly competitive, and if you had an advantage over your competitors, you kept that advantage to yourself. But the thing that I found really strange about the Chamberlains was that they kept these forceps not just in a box, but in a huge box that looked like a coffin, because they didn't want to give away even what size this tool was. And then apparently they blindfolded the woman who was in labor just in case she might want to see that forcep and then tell someone else about it. And I just cannot imagine, even in the 1600s, I can't imagine now that any woman in labor giving birth and going through that much discomfort would be sitting there taking notes about some sort of high-tech thing going on so they could, you know, sell it or share the secret with someone else.
Yeah. That's just, I guess, another one of these examples when, at least early on, physicians were maybe more part of the problem than part of the solution.
Yeah.
And I guess here another thing I'm thinking about is for such a long time, one of the really serious threats to the life of a woman was infection, and that before physicians really, before medical science really understood the germ theory and understood the importance of really basic things to be done for infection control, the doctors were really part of the problem, spreading infection that could end up being fatal from one woman to another.
They were. And now I just do want to say, this isn't sort of a doctor bashing book, but everybody was spreading infections. You know, we didn't keep statistics then, so doctors were saying, oh, the midwives are spreading infections. They didn't call them infections. The midwives are more dangerous. The midwives were saying the doctors are more dangerous. We really don't know. But we do know that no one was washing their hands. We didn't know about germs. And people, whether they were midwives or physicians, if they were going from patient to patient or sick patient to pregnant patient, they were spreading germs. A simple remedy of washing your hands and keeping women clean would have done a lot. We also know that around that time, maternity wards, hospitals, were really for the desperate women. You know, if you could afford to stay away from the hospital, you did. And the women that ended up in a hospital, they were probably more at risk because the germs were spreading.
Yeah, that's what I suppose even today, maybe people would say half seriously, that if you want to stay well, you want to stay away from the hospital, because that's obviously...
Oh, yes, I hear people say it now. When they said it back then, they were right.
Yeah, obviously, they work very hard at infection control, but the fact of the matter is, if you concentrate people who are sick, and then also I'm sure that anyone, physician, midwife, anyone, if you're seeing a lot of different people over a very short period of time and going from one person to the next, you're increasing your potential for being a vector of disease. So it just seems sort of natural that could well happen.
You certainly are. And now there were a few astute doctors who were noticing this. And of course, they were sort of hated by everyone else because no one wants to be called. I mean, there were doctors saying, you know, we're murdering women, you know, and they didn't really like that language. And there was one doctor in Scotland that actually tracked midwives, male and female midwives, and were able to then say, well, this woman or that man is causing the most deaths. You know, they're carrying something from patient to patient. He was not well-regarded. He wasn't liked very well by his colleagues, but he was correct. There's been historians that have gone back and looked at his data, and he really did some, you know, very good statistical work to show how women were put in danger by both male and female midwives.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus is Randi Epstein. She's a medical journalist and a physician. She has written for a number of publications, and she has a new book out that looks at the history of childbirth. The title of her book is Get Me Out. It's published by W.W. Norton. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. There was a time when maternity hospitals were known as lying in hospitals. In fact, I think there might actually still be some that are still called that, in honor, homage to the old name, or you know, whatever. And that was a reflection of the fact that the idea was that either before giving birth or after giving birth, or maybe both, that women essentially were supposed to just lie down.
It was called confinement, and it was a good name because you were confined to bed. You were confined in there. And, yes, it was called lying in because you just lied there before, usually not that much time before, but certainly after. It was considered dangerous to get out of bed too soon, to walk around, and everything was monitored. Some hospitals even thought it was dangerous to sit up after. You just had to lie still. And it's interesting because from what I've researched, there was never any scientific study to say this is how long you should lie in bed or this is when you should get up. It's really all cultural. When women started getting up sooner, it was because they said, we want to get back to work. We don't want to lie here. We probably can. And they did, and they showed that it was safe.
Yeah. I think that's another of the things that I think that you really point to is that so much of this, our attitudes toward sex and birthing and so forth, motherhood, fatherhood, all that kind of stuff, really is cultural. And just one place that you can see it is how over time people have thought about this very question of how soon after giving birth can a woman resume whatever her regular activity is.
It's exactly right. I mean, I look at this history of childbirth really as a cultural history through the lens of childbirth, because so much of what we've done really reflects what we think of women at the time or what we think of couples or parenting. You know, whether it's how long you should stay in bed or what you should eat or when you looked back in the ancient texts and they said basically, you know, women were just these hollow things. These are all sort of reflections of what we thought of made sense in the culture.
We have a caller here. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a caller here in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Yeah, thanks. I was very influenced years ago by a small book called Witches, Midwives, and Nurses.
Yep, I have.
Barbara Ehrenreich and Deidre English. I think some of the material that went on to be good in the book For Your Own Good, I guess it's called. And they make this, you know, kind of cultural thesis that, you know, at the same time witches were being burned, midwives, mainly Celtic cultural things, were being, you know, ousted from their role as birth makers. And that's when, I think they had a pretty graphic picture of a forceps on the cover that they asserted that it wasn't just used for failed pregnancies, that it was actually something that in those days they used. So I don't know whether you want to comment on something like that, but the other thing I was prompted by to call by was this idea of this theory of the complete male role, women as incubator kind of thing. And there's another book, it's quite influential to me, parts of it, called A Brief Liberal Catholic Defense of Abortion, which was published by U of I Press, which goes into sort of the cultural and scientific history of the supposed discovery of the homunculus, which was already expected to be there because of this theory of the woman as incubator didn't rely on science entirely, but that maybe because people expected to see that, you know, when the first microscopes came out, people swore that they saw a complete, you know, human form.
And they looked like mini adults. They didn't even look like fetuses. They looked like little adults.
Right. So, and they, this pair of philosophers in the West Coast make an argument that that's when the Catholic Church took their changed their stance. They always sort of had this Augustine idea of the quickening one in Solomon had, and that, you know, if we have scientific 17th century scientific evidence that there is a homunculus in the sperm, then of course the being is actually there before conception, as it were, and that's when the Catholic Church changed its stance about when life began, if they had much of a developed one. I mean, obviously there were different strains inside, but there was no ceremony for miscarriages or anything like that. And now that there are some fanatic Catholics that are doing that now, I think. But anyway, that's a bit of a digression. But I think it sort of gets into the cultural milieu that you're describing. And I'll just ask for your reaction.
Sure, it's interesting. I have Erin Reich's book, and I loved it. And I think her book that looks at some of, you know, what was going on with these early midwives, and I refer to some of the stories in that book in my book because it's fascinating. I mean, there was a time when men were just starting to come into the picture and doctors, and if things went wrong, and they point out in their book, you know, it was thought, well, this can happen during pregnancy. But way back when, there were times when if a female midwife were helping deliver a baby and if things went wrong, I mean, they were burned at the stake. They were considered witches because somehow they cursed this and somehow they caused the baby to come out either, you know, deformed or whatever happened. So it really does reflect some of these tensions and some of the fears of what these midwives were doing and what the powers. Did they have some secret powers? I mean, they say that some of these Salem witch trials, really a lot of these so-called witches were midwives. And it was an angry society when things went wrong. They blamed the midwife. And in terms of the second book you talk about, I'm not familiar with the book, but it's fascinating. And what you talk about is really intriguing. I do not look into abortion in my book, but what I do talk about, which also looks at the cultural influences, is there was this, doctors saw this decline in fertility among sort of the wealthy white upper class women at the turn of the century, and they worried about, and a lot of sort of the religious leaders came on into this debate, they worried about the amount of children that some of the poor immigrant women were having, and they didn't understand why their fertility rates were so high. And there was this fear, and it was expressed by politicians, by religious leaders, by doctors, of our society being overrun by the lower class types, and it did promote things in terms of how do we reduce the fertility of these dirty immigrants, and how do we increase the fertility of women and get them to have more babies, of the wealthier women that we wanted to procreate.
Well, I want to thank the caller. Get on to another. We have someone here in Champaign, and this is line number two. Hello.
Hi, my question is regarding inducing women to go into labor, and when did that start, and why, and is it possible that the due date is a week or two off nowadays, and that too many women are being induced to go into labor when their bodies are not ready?
You know, it's interesting, and it is a debate going on now. You know, I remember, this is not in my book, but I do remember as a reporter, in the 1990s, someone wrote an article in one of the scientific journals saying, let's get away from giving specific due dates, because then people are saying, I'm 2 days late, or I'm 2 days early. And, you know, your doctor said here, your baby's going to be due, you know, May 24th. It could be 2 weeks before, 2 weeks after. And these doctors proposed, and because they were so against all these inductions, they said, why don't we just say your baby's going to be born sometime in May? Or, you know, sort of just give this one-month window period where it's all safe. And this way maybe it will reduce women from insisting or getting nervous that they're either too early or too late, because you can be a few weeks early, 2 weeks late, without it being that harmful. But I think that just culturally, people like to know a date. I don't think people want to go to the doctor and have their doctor say, sometime in this month you can give birth, you know, with healthily. Now, that said, you know, there are times when if a doctor sees the baby is in distress, whether there's not enough amniotic fluid or for whatever reason, that they are probably saving a life by inducing and getting the baby out. On the other hand, you know, it is probably done for convenience, and there are people that say, well, you know, I'm 36 weeks pregnant, I'm 38 weeks pregnant, let's get the baby out. And people say, well, sure, you know, there's no problem in doing it. There's some tantalizing evidence, nothing definite, where people say, well, you know, there's a reason for when the baby comes out at a certain time, and your hormones change, and there's surges of hormones that go on in the woman's body, and perhaps this is giving the final touches to the baby, needed final touches. But again, it's still a mystery, and we don't know.
All right. Again, questions welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email at will-talk. Will-talk at illinois.edu. When was the first recorded cesarean birth? How long have we been attempting that procedure?
Oh, gosh. Well, that's kind of a little bit of a yucky history, because cesarean sections occurred, you know, when cesarean sections were done before anesthesia and way, way back when. They were done basically when there was no hope that the mother was going to live and you wanted to get the baby out. Because if you were cutting into the woman and there was no anesthetic, there was no, you know, we didn't know about germs, most likely, you know, your next trip was to the morgue, not to go home with the baby. And there's, you know, I talk about in the book that, you know, everyone says, oh, cesarean section, it was named after Caesar. Well, a lot of historians and medical historians that have looked back said, you know, when Caesar was born, if his mother had had a C-section, there's no way she would have lived. And she did live to see her son be ruler. So they don't think that Caesar was born by cesarean section. There are a few recorded instances early on of women who have survived by C-sections. Some women who did, like, these do-it-yourself C-sections, you know, desperate women who somehow had to get the baby out. And there's some, we don't really know what's true. There's one doctor that supposedly a few hundred years ago did a C-section, or a husband, I'm sorry, not a doctor, a husband did a C-section on his wife. Again, we don't know if that's true. But when C-sections really started to be safe, again, makes sense, is when we understood germ theory, when there was anesthesia, so you didn't feel the pain of the C-section. So we're talking then in the early 1900s, although there were scattered reports from years before that.
Yeah, I guess the reason for asking the question would be to also to talk a little bit about the continuing, what seems to be continuing controversy today about C-sections and about the fact that some physicians, I think a lot of OBGYNs, think that we have too many of them.
Yeah, it's hard to tell. You know, it's interesting. In the early 1900s, there were medical articles, and it was fun going back and reading some of the journal articles then, and there was one journal article that said, what are we going to do about this epidemic of C-sections? About 2% of women in major cities are having C-sections, and we're hitting an epidemic proportion. I mean, now it's upward of, you know, 30%. In some hospitals, it's closer to 40% of women having C-sections. It is so hard to piece apart, you know, what is, you know, a necessary C-section and what is not. The one thing we do know from recent surveys is that very few women are saying, it does occur, but few women are saying, I don't want to go through labor, I just want a C-section. Some women are happy that they were that their doctors say, you know what, you'd be safer having a C-section. Other women aren't. The rate does seem too high. What I think part of it has to do with is lawsuits. I think that, you know, you're never, I shouldn't say never, it's unlikely to get sued for doing a C-section, but doctors are worried they could be sued for not doing one. So if they're on the fence and a little worried, I think for legal reasons, they're more pushed to do a C-section.
Well, I think that certainly there has been criticism of physicians doing C-sections because some people would say, well, it's all about their convenience.
At the same time,
yeah, I think that at least occasionally you hear about women saying, well, you know, maybe it's okay with them that it can be a scheduled event.
Sure.
So that really makes you wonder, well, to what extent is a doctor's pressing to do this because it makes things easier for them? Are there women who actually say, well, okay, that actually makes it easier for me? And do both, is there some interest in both sides in having these procedures.
Right. I mean, that does happen. And it's interesting from what that last caller was saying about inductions. You know, it does make you think, well, gosh, if you're planning your C-section for a Monday and, you know, you've done your 9 months, I don't know, you know, would something have different happened in your body on Wednesday when you went into labor that would add those nice final touches to the baby? Maybe, but maybe not. You know, studies really, you know, according to the scientific evidence, most C-sections turn out okay and you're safe. Same with vaginal deliveries. You know, most of the time things turn out okay. So it's hard to look at the studies now and say what we're doing is safe or not. You know, I tend to err on the side of letting the baby come out when the baby's ready to come out, unless there's some serious danger involved.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of focus is Randi Epstein. She is a physician and medical journalist. She's author of the new book, It's a History of Childbirth, From the Garden of Eden to the Sperm Bank. That's the subtitle, and the main title is Get Me Out. It's recently been published by Norton, W.W. Norton. And questions, again, questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Something that's a theme and that certainly runs through the book, and you talk about a good deal, is pain associated with childbirth. And you have to go back to, you do go back to, and I'm sure a lot of other people will go back to the Old Testament, where as part of Eve's punishment for what happened there, that she would have pain in childbirth. And
not just her, but all of them.
Not just her, but all of her daughters, all of the descendants, yes, not just her. Women, this was visited upon women, and the guys were condemned to being in the waiting room and waiting to hand out cigars, I guess.
And they were condemned to smoking cigars.
So it's kind of smoking cigars. And some people would say that might be just as bad. What's interesting is that this association with pain and childbirth, it being in a lot of people's minds just, you know, part of the deal, and in some weird way, it's been turned into a test, some sort of strange test.
Sure.
For women to see what it, you know, to see a test of their womanhood, to see what a woman can put up with.
Yeah, it's so odd. I mean, I have to say, I had dental surgery a few days ago, and it was like, you know, give me pain relief. I didn't care, and I didn't have any moral issues of whether I was going to get knocked out so I could get, you know, all this surgery done. But when it comes to childbirth, I find it fascinating. You look back in history and the swings of whether we deserve pain relief or we don't. It goes back and forth. What I find fascinating, though, is even today, we're so judgmental about each other. I cannot tell you how many women have said to me, I had an epidural, and I feel like I have to make an excuse. I'm out with my babies, and people ask. People always have to ask, you know, so did you need the epidural? Did you have it? And I feel I have to rationalize. I don't feel that I'm as valiant as the women who did it pain-free. And for some reason, we're still judgmental. We're still worried about that it's going to seem like a cop-out. You know, shockingly, though, what I did find is that in the early 1900s, wanting to be knocked out was this feminist crusade, and there were a group of feminists, but when the drugs were quite dangerous, who said, this is great. I went to the hospital, and I don't remember anything about childbirth. This is what we should do, and it became a feminist cause to tell your doctors, knock me out. Don't let me remember any of this.
And that's very striking and very strange that in a period of less than 100 years, so really we're only talking about, you know, maybe 50, 60 years, we should go from people, and as you say, feminists, you know, well-educated, thoughtful women saying, look, I don't want to know. I just want to wake up and say, where's the baby, and have the baby handed to me, to go from that to the point where women today should be apologizing about wanting to have some pain relief. That's very strange, and I suppose, again, it tells you something about the impact of attitudes of the moment on all of these things.
I think it says the impact of what's going on in society, and it also shows that, you know, having a baby, what you'd think of as sort of this private, intimate thing, has always been everybody's business. People just always think that they can ask you and judge anything, you know, how you went through pregnancy, what you ate, how much weight you gained, what pain relievers you used, has always been everybody's business.
Mm-hmm. Maybe another one of the major sorts of trends, the things that has happened. I was joking about the guys in the waiting room smoking cigars. Well, one of the big things I think that has changed in recent decades is that men have become much more involved. Dads are there.
Sure.
In some cases, they're ready there with their hands out to receive the baby, and they have been brought into the process so they can really feel that they're there and that they're a participant, and it's not just that they're waiting to get the word, is it a boy or is it a girl?
Right, and that, again, was something that women encouraged. I mean, a lot of the book, you know, so many people said to me, is this a book of, you know, things that doctors or male doctors have done to women? And it certainly isn't. So many changes that have happened in childbirth have been there because women have insisted, because women have said this is the way we want things done. And it was really women that came and said, you know, we want our husbands there. We want them in the room. Now, of course, doctors were a little hesitant at first. They didn't need someone else in the room with them. And we're talking, you know, hospital births. Men slowly creeped in. You know, first they were, you know, they weren't even in the hospital. And then they were in their little stork club room that they were called. And then eventually they were by the women's side. And then they got a job. You know, Lamaze had men coaching. I'm not so sure, you know, we really think men are coaching now. But they're there watching. And now it's probably the opposite. You'd think it's terrible if someone said, well, you know, my husband was still at the office when I was in the hospital giving birth.
Yeah, he was playing golf.
Right, I was about to say that. But, you know, in I Love Lucy, in that episode, and I contrast the way it shows on television, the I Love Lucy episode where she gives birth to little Ricky, she says to her husband, you go to the Tropicana Club? You know, go ahead, go to work, dance with those other women, and I'll give birth. You know, and then I end the chapter with in the 70s when in All in a Family, where Gloria and Michael, he's there coaching next to her. And Archie was all upset that his son was sitting there in the birthing room watching her give birth.
So who was Lamaze? And how do we come to have this sort of package of how you're supposed to go at childbirth now?
Lamaze was a French doctor who could care less that these women in America named this whole organization about him, and he barely gave them the time of day. And he came up with his idea. It was really because he and another French doctor were studying this Russian scientist called Pavlov. And we all know about Pavlov because he did, you know, the Pavlovian dogs where you ring a bell and you make dogs salivate. Mm-hmm. And these scientists thought, well, gosh, that's fascinating, the physiology of that. You know, if we can ring a bell and make dogs salivate, maybe there's something we can do to make women relax during childbirth and ease the pain. So that's how the whole sort of Lamaze thing came about, like a biofeedback kind of response. And so they started this in France. They did not call it Lamaze. They called it was a psychoprophylactic way of giving birth. Some women in America, one of them, Elizabeth Bing, who I got to meet and talk to about the book, and hear, you know, from the, you know, they heard about him way back in the 40s when natural childbirth wasn't really known about, and they decided that psychoprophylactic way of birth was just not a title that was going to catch on. So they called it Lamaze because they love Dr. Lamaze, and one of the women had gone and given birth in France with Dr. Lamaze. But he really could care less, and Elizabeth Bing told me that when he came to America once and had lunch with her and a few obstetricians from Mount Sinai, he talked to the Mount Sinai doctors and didn't even look at her the whole time and really could care less that they were doing this whole, you know, organization here based on his theories.
We're coming down to the point where you have maybe about 6-7 minutes. Questions, again, are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm certain that across the ages there have been many couples who really wanted to have children and for one reason or another could not, and that it was a source of great sadness and dissatisfaction. I'm sure it broke up a lot of marriages.
And you were allowed to get divorced over it, too, way back when.
And so this was, you know, always the inability to conceive was always an issue. And as we said, I'm sure that also over time there were many different pieces of advice dispensed on how to make sure, if you want to get pregnant, how to make sure you do that.
Sure.
Well, so now we're at a time where we have a highly developed science of infertility.
And a big business.
And a big business. It can be remarkably expensive. And although some people who otherwise would not be able to conceive can be helped, I guess I find myself wondering particularly what it says now and how it affects our attitudes about having children, that we're at this point where one would have to say, given that you have the means, you don't have to accept the idea that you cannot have a baby.
Right. I mean, you know, interestingly, the success rates are still not very high. I mean, they're much higher. I think IVF success rates are somewhere around 25-30%. That means it's 70% failure rate. It's still a difficult process, and there's still many unknowns. But you're right. I think we do go into this, if you have the means, to say, gosh, you know, well, I can buy my sperm here, and I can buy an egg there, and I can even, you know, rent a womb if I want. And I do think it makes the whole process that much more complicated. And it has become a huge business. And I do think that there are women out there saying, well, if my sperm comes from this gorgeous Ivy League guy who just, you know, his essay made him sound so nice, therefore that's what my baby is certainly going to become.
I got an email question here, and I want to make sure that we address it because I think the caller makes an excellent point. She writes that we've been talking about childbirth as something managed only by doctors, OBGYNs, and physicians, and making references to midwives as if that was, you know, something in the dim and distant past. She points out that, in fact, midwives attended 11.3% of all vaginal births in the U.S. in 2006. That's almost double the rate of 91, and would like you to address the fact that midwives, usually nurse midwives, are a very important part of birth in our society now.
She's right, and I'm sorry that the conversation sounded like that. Midwives are a hugely important part, and I think what's happening now, and I wish there was more of this, there are many midwife practices that have now a backup, so you can have your home birth or you can be in a birthing center with a midwife, with an experienced, licensed midwife, and should they find that there's an emergency and you need whatever, the oxygen, something in the neonatal intensive care unit, they have quick access. They have a doctor they can call, and they have quick access. But for the most part, things go along okay, and there are women who, you know, swear by their midwives, and I think It is getting slightly more popular. It's still difficult. It's still difficult for many midwives I know who I've spoken to be able to find offices. They're not as welcome into the medical establishment as they should. And I want to say that they are part of the medical establishment. I said this once before and someone said, well, you're making it sound like they're not part. They are part of the medical establishment, and we should be working with more midwives to make sure that they can be accepted in the community.
Yeah. Just going back to the subject of sperm banks, which is also something that you deal with here, the fact that, yes, it is possible to at least, if you choose to make some choices about who the donor is going to be, and I suppose the idea is that if you know something about that person, know their profile, that it maybe some of what that person is, who they are, is genetically determined, so that maybe your child will have some of that person's traits. It's, of course, a big toss-up. How close are we to that point that some people get so concerned about that a couple would be able to go into some office somewhere and sit down there with a kind of a checklist and say, okay, here's what we want in this baby. We want blonde hair. We want blue eyes. We'd like her to be a Olympic gymnast who is also a concert violinist, and actually check and tall and beautiful and look like Elle McPherson. And, you know, you can actually check off characteristics and tailor your child to your specifications. Is that something that's really likely to the degree people are concerned about?
Well, I think what you can do now, and I did, you can get a personal shopper at a sperm bank. It's an extra fee. And you can, you know, you can't really see what these guys look like, but, like, if you come with a picture of, you know, Brad Pitt or someone you think is really hot, you know, they'll try to match a sperm donor to that. So you can get a personal shopper at a sperm bank to help suit your needs of who you think the ideal sperm donor is. But, again, they're just the sperm donor and they're half the genes. And, no, so, you know, we're not really creating designer babies yet. On the good part, what we can do now is there are many diseases we can screen for. So if your family, and this isn't even sperm, this is your with your own sperm and your own eggs, the great news is that there are certain diseases that if they are genetic diseases and we know the gene and they run in your family, we can look at the embryo and guarantee that that embryo will not have that gene that we transfer into you. So that's great, and there are wonderful things that are happening. And I like to look, in terms of designer babies, that you're going to have this wonderful musician. I mean, the thing that makes me happy as a mother of four is that I still think that parenting has a little bit to do with it. So, you know, in terms of designer babies, I just can't believe we're ever going to get to the state of saying, you know, I want a happy musician who is also really good at football, so I'm going to order that, and then no matter what happens in terms of my parenting or environment, that's not going to play any role whatsoever. Mm.
Just we're coming down to the, just have a couple of minutes left, and this I realize this is a different sort of a question, but I wonder whether you would have any idea about what the numbers of people, couples, who actually make the deliberate choice not to have children are, and whether, and I guess, suppose it's my perception that people like that are viewed as somehow selfish, that they're not doing what they're supposed to do, that there's something wrong with you if you actually decide that you don't want to have children.
You know, it's interesting. I don't look into that in the current. I don't know the statistics now for my book, and it's really hard to say, you know, whether people, I'm sure there are people that say we've chosen not to have children, and maybe they tried and couldn't, but there are certainly people that decided not having kids is something that they didn't want to do, and there probably is still this, you know, frowning upon of our society. I think today we're so politically correct that we kind of keep it to ourselves. But what I do talk about, there were definite times in the 40s and 50s that if you were a couple and you were a woman and you said, you know what, I really want to focus on my career and there's other things, and I'm just not sure I'm really into this parenting thing, that, I mean, you were thought of as seriously as psychiatrically off. I mean, there was something that you just were not coming to terms with your role in society. And there was all this Freudian analysis going on around the 40s and 50s that said, you know, there's something, you're off. That you were mentally ill if you decided that, you know, you'll just pursue a career and not have kids. I don't think nowadays we call you mentally ill, but you're probably right. There are probably people thinking, you know, why are they deciding not to have kids? But we wouldn't go out and write articles and, you know, diagnose them with anything now.
So probably as a result, you mentioned the fact that you do indeed have four children.
Yes.
So you note something about pregnancy and birthing. But are there some really important thing, do you think, that you actually learned as a result of doing all the work that went into writing Get Me Out?
From the research you're saying, or going through my own experience?
No, from the research.
From the research, I do think, you know, just to reiterate what I was saying before, I do think there's something, you know, one of the things is that there's still so many things we don't know about making a baby. And I guess from my research and from my own experience, there's something that we just, I guess it's human nature, that we still feel that we are going to control this uncontrollable event. I think if I were to become pregnant again tomorrow, somehow, despite all my research, I'd still think, okay, wait, I'm going to eat this, or I'm not going to do this, or I'm going to try to relax, or I'm going to think happy thoughts, which all sounds so silly, but we all kind of think, well, it can't hurt, and we want to make sure. We'll do whatever it takes to make sure that we have this healthy baby.
Our guest this morning, Randi Epstein, is medical journalist and physician. Her book is Get Me Out, A History of Childbirth, From the Garden of Eden to the Sperm Bank, published by W.W. Norton. And Dr. Epstein, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus 580 will continue, so please stay tuned.
Vintage Vinyl is coming up on Saturday, May 8th. Start packing your used CDs, records, DVDs, tapes, and working stereo equipment now. And beginning March 31st, drop them off at any Busey Bank office in Champaign, Urbana, or Savoy. Call Dean Geiken at 217-333-6503 for more information.
Support comes from Subaru of Champaign County, located on Route 45 in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieved zero landfill status, with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700. Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey. Let's go right out to the pits in Kansas City. May wheat at 490 and a half.